Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I'm delighted to introduce you to David Siegel, former CEO of Meetup, Investopedia, Seeking Alpha. He's led these companies to 7x, 5x exits. He's the author of a bestseller, Decide and Conquer, a professor at Columbia, and fellow alum of University of Pennsylvania, class of 97. David, welcome to the pod.
Listen, my biggest claim to fame is just the fact that we were in the same class together, 97, so whatever it is, 28 years ago. And
you know, I'm interviewing you,
from,
man.
From you back in the day.
I'm interviewing you. I love it. I'm calling my mom right after this. It's like, look, thank you for that great education. Here's the people.
It was a great day.
So, David, so many topics to cover. I want to make sure we also jump into your latest initiatives, such as the Israel Tech Initiative that you started. But let's start at the beginning. You know, we graduated, and then you started consulting for a company that was serving DoubleClick. And tell us about that journey, what you've learned, and where it paid off down the road.
Exciting time. So when we were both at Penn together, actually, I went to Princeton for a conference by an organization called APAC for college students. And I remember meeting this guy, and I was 19 or 20 years old. And I said to him, hey, like, I have no idea what the hell I want to do the rest of my life. Like, how do you figure out what do you want to do? And he's like, okay, if you don't know anything at all, and you have no idea what you want to do, go into consulting, because you don't need to know anything. You just pretend like you know stuff and you get exposed to all these other things. So I was like, sounds great. I'll go into consulting. So while I was in school with you, I worked for a consulting firm called William Mercer, which is a management consulting firm. And I figured I would get a little leg up on people by having like an internship while I was working and while I was, you know, in the summertime. So I did consulting, and then I got a job after school because I didn't know anything in consulting. And then basically, after a couple of years, we focused on merger and acquisition integration consulting, which is an awesome role where after companies get acquired, you figure out how do you manage the company? What do you keep? What do you not keep? Biggest client was DoubleClick. At the time, DoubleClick was like, I'm not going to say the ChatGPT of like today, but it was like the biggest internet company in the New York City area. It controlled all online advertising, ultimately got acquired by Google. And what happened is the CEO of DoubleClick is a guy named Kevin Ryan. And he reached out to me one day while I was consulting. And he said, hey, David, what do you get paid as a consultant? And I'm like, oh, I get paid, you know, 40 grand a year, because, you know, that's what you get out of college back in those days, which was actually pretty good. And he's like, how about this? You're charging like 6x that, $40,000 per hour. And why don't we just double your salary and we could pay less than half of what we're paying for you? I'm like, sounds like a win-win. So that's how I ended up at DoubleClick. And DoubleClick was just, they say there's a famous PayPal mafia that Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and others are a part of. But in the New York tech scene, DoubleClick has this group of people that there's over 200 CEOs and presidents of tech companies that have come from early days of DoubleClick. The current CEO of YouTube, for example, a guy named Neil Mohan, and I, you know, used to hang out all the time at DoubleClick and many other people. So DoubleClick, like,
oh my god, really... so Neil was my classmate at Stanford well. So
okay, sorry, I got to tell you something about Neil, Alex. So,
he's super smart guy too. Yeah,
like, he's very, very smart. I set Neil up with his wife.
Well, you win. You win. That's that's some serious relationship building.
There you
And
go.
he's happily married, so there you go.
He's happily married. I see his posting his kids all the time. I'm like, oh, those kids, because I was like, oh, you're Indian. I know this really attractive Indian woman. You guys should go out. And he's like, okay.
Oh, so you became an Indian auntie as well on
I'm
top
basically an Indian auntie at the wedding. They all had me give a standing ovation to me and a friend of mine that did the setup. It was great.
All
He's a
right.
great
So if
guy.
you're still single and listening to this podcast, keep in mind that David is a good person to know.
Yes. I've set up 3 weddings so far. So I'm working on my fourth one day. Just give me a call.
All right. So and then Kevin Ryan, right, and this whole DoubleClick Mafia, right? That's actually like he's a legendary leader now in New York. How many unicorns this single guy
Kevin Ryan
has
is insane.
started?
So the guy built MongoDB, multi-billion-dollar company, Business Insider, Zola, the Gilt Group. He runs a thing called Alicorp. And just not to be a spoiler alert, but we stayed in touch for 25 years. And then when I was part of WeWork and hired by Adam Neumann, I did a management buyout of my company Meetup out of WeWork. And who did I call? I called Kevin
Kevin
Ryan.
Ryan, yeah,
So,
I
and I can
love
tell
that
more of the
story.
story
Yeah,
later on.
yeah,
But yeah,
yeah. That's great.
it's all a big circle.
Well, I think Kevin, like, clearly is a spotter of talent because he's kind of picked you out. A few years in consulting, right? He saw the kernel of genius there,
Yeah,
and then
baby.
tell me, like, then you were like, then Seeking Alpha, like it's a product that I remember loving because if I was too cheap to buy an equity research report, you would be the destination. Investopedia, despite my work in education, I needed to look up things in there. That's great.
I mean,
Democratizing finance. Tell us about that. Kind of
which
what did
one,
you
Seeking
love
Alpha or
about these?
Investopedia?
Well,
What are
like
you
I
interested in,
think those
both?
two, like I feel like they come together a little
Yeah,
bit
they
in
do.
terms of the focus. I'd love to hear what are kind of lessons learned in terms of really democratizing understanding of finance, making investment decisions. For people that are not equity research brokers, JP Morgan and Goldman.
Yeah. The secret sauce to Seeking Alpha is something that if I gave you probably 20 guesses, you wouldn't guess, and most people wouldn't guess. But actually, it's as you use the word democratization, it's a really important word. It's actually the comments on the articles that are written, meaning Seeking Alpha has an incredibly deep and active member base who are passionate about fundamental stock analysis. And really, really understanding the metrics behind a business, as opposed to crypto investing or whatever. So someone will write an article, and there'll be not two or three like some articles would have, but like more like the average article had 60, 70, 80, 100, literally average ones. Some had hundreds of comments. And if you're interested in equity research, and you don't want to pay, tens of thousands of dollars from Bloomberg or FactSet or the others, man, Seeking Alpha has such impressive levels of research on articles. But what's more impressive is actually the thoughtful comments and disagreements and debates that occur in the comments section of articles. And I really always encourage people to look at the comments. It's almost like a Talmudic dispute that will exist
Love it. I
in
love it. This is like
after
this
these
is the
articles.
Torah of finance. All
There you
right. I
go.
love it.
Exactly.
So
Exactly.
how do you cultivate that? Because typically when we think of comments on the internet, we see like either something really snarky on
Right.
X or something incredibly douchey on YouTube.
Right.
And you managed to find this passionate community. Did you incentivize it? It just naturally happened and you just didn't remove friction from it. Like what was the How did you create this? This does sound special, and you're absolutely right. I had no idea that that was the magic.
Yeah, it's definitely the magic. So number one, just caveat is I was not the founder of Seeking Alpha. It was actually founded by an incredible guy named David Jackson in Israel. He was CEO. I became CEO of Investopedia and Meetup. I was president of Seeking Alpha. But just want to clarify that. In terms of Seeking Alpha, the reason why I was able to create that secret sauce and what others can do as well is their model for editorial content was very different than your typical like Forbes or Fortune or Wall Street Journal. They had obviously all those all those places had, paid experts, journalists, et cetera. Seeking Alpha's model was a network of 5 to 10,000 contributors. They built this contributor network of people who were, I like to call them prosumers. So they were like consumers, but professional consumers, or they could have been high net worth traders, or they could have been professional finance people, but they were not journalists who would
Right.
be passionate about a certain stock, really be interested in investing in that stock, where they would write articles. They were incented on page views. So they were incented to the more success that they had in terms of people that were interested in reading and writing about it. But the people who wrote the best comments and were most engaged were other contributors. You get it? So it's
Interesting.
not like the
Interesting.
typical, so yes, typical users did engage, but because they had this such a vast network of really thoughtful contributors, that engagement of people who wrote articles ended up leading into many people who ended up commenting on those articles as well. So it just created this culture of thoughtful comments that people would give. And yes, you got stupid comments of like, this is going to the moon. Like, what the hell does that
Right.
tell you? That's not helpful. But like, but generally speaking, the level of sophistication is very high. And also, Seeking Alpha has moved more towards a subscription service where people have to pay. Because once you create that bar where people are paying, you're going to end up removing a lot of those people that are just
Right.
like, not as
Creepy, yeah,
sophisticated. And you're going to end up with
sophisticated,
a
yeah.
more sophisticated type audience from that as well. So it's a more self-selected group, which helps to drive quality of thoughtfulness.
Got it. So now, President Seeking Alpha, CEO of Investopedia. Tell me about
Investopedia.
Investopedia. That's where it was part of EAC.
Yeah, I got a good
Tell
story there. I gotta tell you
yeah,
the
yeah,
story, Alex.
yeah.
So I was as a president of Seeking Alpha, and then IAC, which is a company run by Barry Diller, publicly
Okay.
traded company, owns Match.com and HomeAdvisor and Angie's List, and it's super successful, multi-billion dollar company. They reached out to acquire Seeking Alpha, and I was president at the time. And we decided to take a meeting with IAC, and because they had just previously acquired Investopedia, and they wanted to have like a roll-up of financial publishers, Investopedia, Seeking Alpha, a whole bunch of others, just like they did in the dating business with OkCupid
Right,
and
right.
all the other ones. So they met with us, and of course, after your meeting, it meant 3 or 4 hours. The most important thing for a founder to say afterwards is, you want me to say it, or do you want to guess?
Do it, do it.
Okay, is we're not for sale,
Right.
because you're only more appealing when you say we're not for sale.
Yes,
So you
yes.
always say we're not for sale. I did that with Meetup. I always do that. That's how you get the big returns.
And then that
So
was your introductions. Like, hey, he's not really looking to date you, anyone. He's like got his Neil's got his stuff together,
that's how we say
but
exactly,
if the
Alex.
right girl comes along from the right kid family, who knows?
Yes, she was a
I'm
lot more
like,
interesting than he was, but he played hard to get. That's how he was able to get her,
there
Neil.
you go. There you go.
I hope he's listening now. I'm sure he's not, but
No, it's just my mom. It's just my mom right now. Don't worry.
so basically I said like, we're not for sale. Then we met with a second time. I said, we're not for sale. And then the IAC head of M&A, a guy named Mark Stein, he calls me up and he goes, okay, I get it. I get it. You're not for sale, Seeking Alpha. But David, are you for sale? So I'm like, I'm for sale. So he's like, okay, this is what we like to pay to have you be, the CEO of Investopedia and take over the company. So that's how I ended up as part of IAC and Investopedia. And I when I came, it was a very small business, maybe $10, $11 million in revenue. And then when I left 5 years later, it was up to 35 to 40 million in revenue. So it was a really incredible success story. And then we sold the company.
Fantastic. So it sounds like IAC pulled another Kevin Ryan on you, just pulled you out, paid you premium, and got a
Yeah, I
great
mean,
return.
they heard that you and I were classmates, so that helped.
There you go. There you go. The legendary class of 97. All right. So now probably to the company everybody has heard of, but I'm having their mug here if you could kind of see it through it.
You stole a WeWork mug, didn't you, Alex?
I am at WeWork right now, actually.
Oh, so no
Yeah,
stealing. Okay,
so
you're
no
actually just using
stealing,
it.
but so on the on this journey, right, at WeWork, right? Running a business that is all about, face-to-face experiences, but have has a sort of a digital roots. What did you bring to WeWork, and what did you learn from WeWork, right? Before the whole, dramatic exit and whatever happened, right? But like, I imagine there was something special, and well, crazy, but there's also something special that you could learn from the
Oh,
ambition
a
of the WeWork
tremendous
journey.
amount I learned from WeWork. So number one, I mean, listen, you learn what not to do, which is to set the right, not to set such false expectations. But there's also things that they did really well. And I think a lot of people like to rank negatively on WeWork, but that's not fair because they also created still even a billion-dollar company, even if it's not worth $47 billion like it was originally. It's still a very impressive
It's not
company.
trivial to create anything of
It's
value.
not trivial. WeWork has
And
been
I am a
in
member of WeWork right now because actually I enjoyed the experience.
very
So just to
nice,
be
very
clear,
nice.
so it's not
Okay.
a right.
So let me share a couple things that WeWork I thought did exceptionally well. Number one, they were very, very good at hiring incredibly talented individuals at the executive ranks and in leading organizations. I think their eye for talent, their aggressiveness, their ambition, all those things really pushed every single CEO of a company to get far more aggressive in their goals and what they thought they could potentially achieve than if they were not a part of WeWork. And it would happen all the time that, as CEO of Meetup, which, I reported into the president of the company, a guy named Artie Minson, who, was kind of Adam Neumann's right-hand person. He was the CFO and president. I would not have been as aggressive in looking to build Meetup into kind of the multi 190 different countries that that Meetup is in, and if not for WeWork's kind of cultural influence.
Got
So
it. So if I had to recap it, you're WeWork, you're bigger than life. Anything you acquire, the culture you build, forces by cultural norms, by reporting norms, everybody to aim higher, go to unlimited, go to extra, extra, extra version of what you could
correct.
be.
And also they created a culture of like being real and mission and incredible mission orientation. Incredible mission orientation, which I think is very motivational for employees. And it's not and talking about how you're looking to change the world is something that I think every founder and CEO can learn from. I think it for most people, especially millennials and Gen Zers as well. They're not looking just to work and get a paycheck. They're looking to feel like they're having a positive impact on the world. And finding the way in which what your company does is truly improving the quality and life for other people is something WeWork did exceptionally well. And I think a lot of CEOs can learn from.
Brilliant. So building on the meetup story, right? So what do you want to share with us, right? Like everybody wants to have great human experiences. I think we live in a world where we're getting our a replacement of in-person with media that sometimes works and sometimes probably hurts us more than
Could be
it
very
helps us.
unhealthy.
Yeah, it could be very unhealthy even for the, and so I'm at a stage where I'm managing my media inputs even, right?
Good.
Where just to get control of what I feed into my mind. And I think a lot of people are anybody who, we have kids, it's kind of a losing fight, but it's a fight worth fighting, I
Very
think.
important, yes.
And so you created a way for people to connect, right? And get together and discover new people. I think it's a tremendous mission and opportunity. And like, tell me what you've learned, what surprised you about humans,
Oh,
and like
wow.
what were fun things that came out of some of these meetups?
Yeah, sure. So, Meetup's mission is to end the loneliness epidemic that exists in the world. And it's a global epidemic. There's been many studies on it, according to the Surgeon General of the US recently talked about how loneliness is more dangerous than smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. Loneliness could lead to the average person's life being 7, 10 years younger. Over 40% of people at some point regularly feel lonely. And among young people, it's much more acute. Among people in bigger cities, it's much more acute. And our goal is to use technology to get people off of technology, which is really important, especially young people off of technology,
Right.
especially for brain development, et cetera. So in terms of, I mean, obviously incredible number of lessons learned, but one thing is that I could say many, but one of them is humans are humans, meaning we go back millions of years to Paleolithic and Neolithic man. The way in which we survived millions of years ago was actually in groups. Someone went out of the group and lived in their own cave, they died. In order to survive, they need to be part of hunters and gatherers and be together. So we have this DNA built within us for literally hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens. And when we try to separate out from our natural state, which is community, which is the importance of being together, we are depressed. And it leads to massive depression, leads to anxiety, leads to, God forbid, self-harm when people don't have community. So I always believed it. I always know it. I knew community was important. I have a strong sense of community in my personal life as well. And at times I haven't had community, but I didn't realize how acute it was. I've had dozens of people, I'm not kidding, as the CEO of Meetup, tell me that Meetup saved their life. Literally, there are an example, someone is LGBTQ. They didn't want to come out. They joined an LGBTQ plus Meetup and group, and they were able to find their people. Their ADHD, they didn't know how to function, and they found people and they found therapies and they found ways, part of breast cancer support group or hiking groups or whatever it is. So that's one major learning, is just like the criticality of community is a big takeaway. Another takeaway that I also like to
David,
talk
before
about.
you go there, I mean, I think you're probably too modest of the number of marriages that you're responsible for.
Yeah,
I mean,
probably
I
true.
like if you take the number of years you were in charge of Meetup and the number
Oh, right. Tens of thousands.
of yeah,
Tens of thousands.
you're just like you're Mother Teresa of connecting
Thank
people here,
you. Thank you. No, literally tens of
this is God's work. All right.
I did a fun thing as CEO of Meetup. I would go around the world actually and do a Meetup event in like in Dublin and in Barcelona and in San Francisco and like 10, 20 different in Saudi Arabia even in different cities. And we'd invite people to hear talking about community and meetup and stuff like that. But every time I talk, someone walk over to me and say, "I'm my spouse 'cause of Meetup.
Yeah.
I got my job 'cause of Meetup." I mean, it's a really special platform, and it's because like when you get people together in person, we have
Yeah.
digital too, of course, which
Yeah.
started during COVID, but in person, it's like that's where the magic happens. So first thing is just
Too
to
bad
say.
IAC didn't acquire you. They should have been the buy. This could have been like
Anyway,
Match.com meetup.
we were looking to get acquired. We hired a banker and we met with Match.com. We met with Bumble. We actually had done a biz dev deal with Match.com where they wanted to connect people for dating purposes by going to meetup events. So there was definitely something there. And I reached out to the CEO of IAC, a guy named Joey Levin. Who I love, who's I used to work for, and I said, "You should acquire us," and he's like, "Ah, it's not our thing, da da da." So it didn't work out, but we tried.
All right, so Meetup, you can have interrupted your flow, but the first thing is just how important it is for people to connect because it's our essence of being human. And second, so what's the second
Okay,
biggest
I'll give you another one,
approach?
which is when you are meeting people. When you're meeting people, because Meetup is all about meeting people, right? It's connecting with her. It's always interesting to me the mix and the overlap of the personal and the professional. Meaning people will go, and this happens all the time. I'll tell you a story. I met this meetup organizer. I said, and he said, I'm an organizer of two groups, a bowling group for personal because I like bowling, and a networking group because I'm looking for a new job, networking thing." He goes, "And I have to tell you, I got my last two jobs from my bowling group, and I met my best friend at the career thing." It's just amazing to me how, people don't understand that possibly a great way to find a job is go on a hiking meetup group. Like, meet
Yeah.
people, talk to them. A great way to like meet friends is you could do something career-wise. And it's just people think of things oftentimes as two separate lanes. I'm a professional David Siegel. on personal David Siegel. And no, like, this should be one and the same. You should be authentic self. You should be the same person, whether I'm professional or, I mean, hopefully you're a good person and handle doing the same. But you know, in both, and I think the learning for me is that the people who gain the most from community is people who are their authentic selves, both in the personal and the professional realm.
This is great. Like a lot of our audience members are in the B2B world. They communicate complex financial topics or other topics like that. And I think there's something weird happens in B2B that we forget that actually it's a human, it's business to human that happens to be working in another
It's an
business.
H to H.
Yeah, it's a human to human. Yeah, like now increasingly it's an AI to AI, but still there's human in the loop somewhere. For the most high stakes things. And I think some of the content just puts you away, you know, into like desperate suicidal mode because it's so boring and you know it's not it's boring to bore bored you something like that. And you gotta kind of bring in your personality, add the real human stories, not some manufactured marketing case
And people
study.
are afraid to do it. They're afraid to be vulnerable. They're afraid to be like who they are. They're afraid they're like, oh, 100, if 100 people see it and one person is pissed off, like forget the one person. 99 people will find it much more interesting. You got to be yourself. You can't like just be all stiff and like try to, if you try to satisfy like everyone, the content's gonna suck.
Right. Well, and this actually leads us into next big chunk of your lessons is the book that you've written, Decide and Conquer. First of all, are you more decide or the conquer type of guy? Where do you where are you on the
I
Genghis
can
Khan
conquer unless you
spectrum?
decide.
Yeah. All right.
I'm a
So
decide, I'm more of a decide and fail kind of guy
you're
myself.
decide, learn, you know, and then conquer. All right. So lots of fantastic lessons for a lot of people. Right now are dealing with confusion around the world flipping on itself, right? AI, we talked about communications and experiences, right? B2B communications has not changed dramatically since you and I were in undergrad. You know, still PDFs are around then, they're around now. You
Crazy.
know, we're trying to fight the good fight and make bringing these babies to life, but like
Kill
it's
PowerPoint, kill PDF, yes.
yeah. Well, we don't even want to kill them. Just kind of use them as a step to something greater if you need to. But the gist that we see is that we obviously see people have some inertia, right? There's a status quo, there's a de facto standard, and people want to do it, but default, want to change, want to try new things, but default to the safer or the lazier options. And so you, in your book, you talked about the faultiness of that worldview. Tell us about what are the risks of status quo,
Ooh, I love it.
yeah.
Okay, so there's a famous quote, and I'll butcher it, so I'll just kind of give the summary of it by President Roosevelt, which is essentially something to the effect of the best decisions are great decisions, the next best decisions are bad decisions, and the worst decision is no decision. And we live in a world where people are afraid of making decisions. There's incredible status quo bias, there's incredible belief that. Hey, the devil I know is a devil, but at least it's the devil I know. I'm afraid of like doing something else. People being stay in bad relationships because it's the devil that they know.
So
People
we're a
live
bunch of frogs boiling in water, basically. It's kind of like, you know, just killing
Exactly. A bunch of
ourselves.
frogs boiling water. But what
Yeah.
people don't realize is this is what I'm gonna say to you, is that not making a decision is a decision.
Yeah.
You're choosing not to make a decision, which most often is actually a very poor decision. But the reason why you're comfortable in that situation is because you're being reactive. I think people feel pain. If they make a bad decision, then they could blame themselves for making a bad decision. The people don't like to blame themselves because people oftentimes lack confidence and don't feel good about themselves. They don't want to blame themselves and feel even worse. So therefore, by not making a decision and some bad thing happening, oh, that's no longer my fault. I can't blame myself anymore. It's just unlucky. And unfortunately, that's what happens all the time with people that they're afraid of making a decision because they could feel bad about it. But not making a decision is actually making a decision and allows them to kind of not feel bad or guilty about making a bad decision when in fact, no decision was actually the worst decision.
This is brilliant on an individual level. Now let's extrapolate this to organizational level, right? You've
Sure.
run companies, you've seen tendencies to do things the way they were, you've shaken things up. Why do you think this happens at an organization? Is it just a bunch
Yeah.
of individuals? Are there other things going on, such as
Big
social
time.
proof, where like, oh, the group is not making this, so I'm not going to stick my head out type of things. Like, tell me a little bit about
Yeah, I
that.
mean, it goes all the way back to like the 19s. I mean, it goes all the way back to humankind. But from a business perspective, like the famous saying about the 1970s and 1980s, no one ever got fired by like hiring IBM. I don't know if everyone's heard that. It's a really old statement. But like the idea that, oh, I'll just take the safe route. If I take the safe route, then I'm not going to get fired. So I think what it comes down to is a couple of different things. Number one is incentives. So if a CEO and or board and or employees are incented to drive significant value creation, then there's going to be much more comfort in taking bigger risks and ultimately failing more often and ultimately making bigger decisions like WeWork did, right? They make really, really big decisions. But oftentimes, there's this concept of I just want to stay under the radar. I don't want to get fired. I don't want a bad thing to happen to me. So I'm just going to do the safe route, do what my manager tells me to do. And that manager, by the way, is also taking the safe route, doing what their manager wants to do. And you have this like horrible dynamic in organizations where oftentimes the CEO is a pretty aggressive person, and she or he, they want to like move things, shake things up, and make changes. But then you get to like the next level, and then they're afraid of getting fired. I think in a lot of organizations, there's this fear that exists because there's been lots of layoffs in tech, right? And there's and then another layoff can happen. And if they just, don't have a target on their back by not making, too many waves, they're going to be safer. And unfortunately, incentives drive a significant amount of behaviors, and that's, I think, the case in many organizations.
Brilliant. Guys, check out the book. We'll put it in the notes. Last thing before we roll up, you are making waves with Israel Tech Mission. Tell me about it. Tell me why it's a passion project that you got involved in, and what impact do you want to make?
That's so nice of you to bring it up. Thank you, Alex. So I sold Meetup almost exactly a year ago. Literally a year and 4 days ago was my last day as a CEO of Meetup. And prior to that, my son, who's actually in the Israeli army, right after October 7th, which is when Hamas had invaded Israel, my son had said to me, he said, "Dad, you know a ton of people in tech, a lot of tech leaders. Maybe you could try to bring a few people to Israel." So I'm like, "Yeah, sure, I'll try." So I called up a couple of big famous people in Israel, and I said, "Hey, I'm thinking of bringing a couple people." They said, "Great." So I just kind of said, "I'm going to start a tech mission to Israel." And I thought I'd bring five, six, seven people. We ended up bringing 65 of the huge number of tech executives, Reid Raymond from Apollo, CFO Warby Parker, all these big names and big people from venture capital firms, millions of dollars I'm getting investing in Israeli companies from it. So then I did a second trip, and then I started an organization called the Israel Tech Mission, which is essentially all about helping to drive investment into a country that I have a particularly strong connection to, which is Israel. Because of the war, the huge number of investments is down. Israel's 50% of Israel's economy is dependent on tech, which is like in the US, it's 9%. So it's a higher percentage than any other country. So it's a way of quote unquote giving back. We brought over 250 tech executives to Israel right now. And hopefully it will continue for many years to come. We're in the middle right now of our fifth trip. And I hope you come on our sixth trip, which is with a lot of founders, which is coming happening in March. We'll see what happens.
David, I love this conversation. I would love to continue it. People can find you where so they could keep getting the wisdom, discovering the book.
I would say
Tell us
LinkedIn is
about
I'm
where
pretty
you.
active on it. I don't know, I have 36,000 or so followers. So I would say LinkedIn is the best. Send me a LinkedIn invite, and if you mention this podcast with Relate To and content experience platform, and I've mentioned Alex Shevelenko, then I will definitely accept your invite. So
You'll
just send me an
accept your
invite and I'll
invite.
do it.
All right. Everybody's paying attention to that. David, you're awesome. Keep being awesome and deciding and conquering for us all. Thanks, man.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relateto.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relateto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.